From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we remember a man who always wanted to have a neighbor just like us. Children's TV host Fred Rogers has died at the age of 74. We'll listen back to a pair of interviews with Mr. Rogers. His show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, is the longest-running program on public television. Also, film critic John Powers reviews All the Real Girls. It won a special award at Sundance this year. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The UN's chief weapons inspector says it would be significant if Iraq destroys its Al-Samud II missiles, as it has pledged to do, but the Bush administration said that even this act of compliance is just another deceptive tactic. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said that President Bush had predicted that Iraq would destroy the missiles as part of what he called its games of deception.
The Iraqi actions are propaganda wrapped in a lie inside a falsehood.
Fleischer repeated the administration position that it will accept nothing less than full disarmament, adding that Iraq is still hiding stockpiles of banned weapons. The State Department is denying that the United States is offering inducements to UN Security Council members to vote for a new resolution on Iraq. Spokesman Richard Boucher was asked about possible incentives as the U.S. announced sanctions against three rebel groups in Chechnya, something long requested by Moscow. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
The U.S., Britain, and Spain are trying to muster 9 votes for the resolution, which could lead to military action against Iraq. They face strong opposition, especially from France and Russia, which have veto power. After announcing sanctions against 3 rebel groups allegedly involved in the taking of hostages at a Moscow theater, Boucher said the U.S. is not offering bribes to council members.
We don't go out and buy votes.
Boucher said the U.S. is involved in intense diplomacy, trying to convince council members to support the new resolution. The council's decision is likely to be influenced by the latest report by U.N. weapons inspectors. The council is getting copies of the report, which will be presented orally next week. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush told workers from about 20 government agencies today that they have to work together to help protect the country from future terrorist attacks. The agencies are moving into the new Department of Homeland Security. NPR's Pam Fessler has more.
The new department is absorbing some big government agencies, including the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the Transportation Security Administration, and the Coast Guard. President Bush said the merger should mean a more effective and organized homeland defense, and that the more than 170,000 workers in the department will be on the front lines.
We created this cabinet department in a time of war. And every professional in the Department of Homeland Security plays a valuable role in winning the first war of the 21st century.
The new agency is supposed to consolidate border protection, emergency response activities, and the defense of key facilities. The administration's been criticized for not providing enough funding for Homeland Security, but President Bush blamed Congress for the shortfall. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow gained 6 points to close at 7,891. The Nasdaq gained 13 points, or 1%. This is NPR News. Attorney General John Ashcroft said today that the Justice Department will fight a federal appeals court ruling that says it's unconstitutional for public school children to recite the Pledge of Allegiance if it includes the words "under God." The San Francisco-based Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals refused today to reconsider its earlier ruling on the issue. 2 senators investigating a management and ethics crisis at the United States Olympic Committee say they've received evidence of possible fraud and criminal activity. NPR's Howard Berkus has details.
Colorado Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell and Alaska Senator Ted Stevens visited the U.S. Olympic Committee campus in Colorado Springs Thursday night and Friday, and they say Olympic athletes and staffers provided information indicating possible fraud in USOC operations. The senators declined to be more specific, but Stevens says the information touches on criminal activity. He adds he's not sure the information can be verified. A law enforcement source tells NPR that the Justice Department would be interested in the allegations if they prove to be accurate. The Senate Commerce Committee is already investigating charges of mismanagement, political turmoil, and ethics lapses among U.S. Olympic officials. Senators have also established an independent panel charged with reforming and reorganizing the USOC. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
The Food and Drug Administration is proposing that labels be required on supplements containing ephedra, warning that the herbal preparation can cause heart attacks, stroke, and even death. The action comes just a week after an ephedra supplement was implicated in the heat stroke death of Baltimore Orioles pitcher Steve Beckler. A leading maker of the supplements, Metabolife International, says its products are safe when they're used as directed. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from American Century Investments, managing money for individuals and institutions for more than 40 years. On the web at AmericanCentury.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's show, we'll remember Fred Rogers and listen back to two of his interviews with us, recorded nearly 20 years apart. Anyone who saw Fred Rogers on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood when they were young, and that's just about everybody, knows a lot about the man who died yesterday at age 74. They know he was kind and loving and trustworthy and enthusiastic and honest and, as a television star, unique. Off camera, based on the handful of times I saw him over the years, I can honestly say he was exactly the same in real life. He cared more about his responsibility as a TV personality and his audience than any entertainer or educator I ever met. By coincidence, Fred Rogers and I got involved in children's television at about the same place and time. His career as a children's TV personality began in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, as the puppeteer, musician, producer, and co-creator of a local TV show called Children's Corner. That show began in Pittsburgh in 1954. I began in Pittsburgh a year earlier. I was born there. So when Fred Rogers and his on-air partner Josie Carey started working together, I was right there as one of their first and youngest viewers. This was a year before the premieres of The Mickey Mouse Club and Captain Kangaroo, and from the very beginning, Rogers served up a gentle, unhurried, very different, very soothing type of TV. He never stopped. He began his own show, Mr. Rogers, for Canada's CBC in 1963. He returned to Pittsburgh and launched Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood as a local show in 1966 and took it national in 1968, where it's been on PBS with original shows or reruns ever since. The more TV changed, the more Fred Rogers remained the same. And the more he stood out, almost like a calm oasis in TV's vast wasteland. By the time he stopped doing original shows 3 years ago, Rogers had amassed a huge and an invaluable library of special and regular shows. Shows like this one, called What Do You Do With the Mad That You Feel?
I remember when I was a boy, if I couldn't do something very well and I'd get frustrated about it, I'd go to the piano and tell it with my fingers on the piano keys. I'll just show you. Are there things that make you angry? Do you have ways of showing you're angry? Ways that don't hurt you or anybody else? What do you do with the mad that you feel when you feel so mad you could bite? When the whole wide world seems oh so wrong and nothing you do seems very right. What do you do? Do you punch a bag? Do you pound some clay or some dough? Do you round up friends for a game of tag? Or see how fast you go? It's great to be able to...
Some of the things I'll remember most vividly about Fred Rogers, though, weren't on his shows. They were from my real-life encounters with him. The first time I met him, and yes, he had that same molasses voice off camera and was just as sweet and deliberate, was when he was visiting Philadelphia to speak to a small kindergarten class. The evening before, when I was with him, he was contacted by Nightline and invited to appear on that night's show. Rogers politely but firmly declined. And when I asked him why, He said he owed it to those kindergarten kids to be as fresh and good as he could be. Another time, when Rogers was accepting a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Television Critics Association, he stood before the country's TV critics, a tough room if ever there was one, and asked them to take a minute to think about the parents, teachers, and other friends and loved ones who had a major influence in getting them to where they were that day. Then he looked at his watch and told them, told us, that he'd let us know when the minute was up. And then he stood there, not saying another word for a full 60 seconds. Before Rogers spoke again, you could hear the sound of silence and some sobbing. In that spirit, I'm going to do something similar when I get off the radio. I'm going to take some more time to think about what Fred Rogers asked us to think about that day. And though he would never have asked it himself, I'll take a moment to think about Fred Rogers, too. Fred Rogers first visited Fresh Air and spoke with Terry Gross in 1984. We'll hear that interview later on today's show. We'll begin with another Fred Rogers interview, this one from just a few months ago. He spoke with Barbara Bogave after the publication of the Mr. Rogers parenting book. He joined Barbara from his studio in Pittsburgh, where he was seated at his piano. Fred Rogers, welcome to Fresh Air. It's such a pleasure.
Thank you, Barbara.
You write about a lot of everyday things. You also write about some pretty profound issues in parenting, about children's fears. I'm remembering a show you once did about how a child cannot go down the drain in the bathtub. You had a whole show about that.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds funny, but you're really meeting kids on their own level. That's a real fear. Did a child write to you, and is that where you got the idea for that?
A child played that out in front of me one time, making a character, trying to see if that character could go down a tube, you know, just a plain, ordinary tube. And I found out that it had to do with the drain in the bathtub. That child was petrified when his parent pulled the plug while he was still in the tub. And so consequently, we wrote a song about that, you know. You can never go down, can never go down, can never go down the drain. And then it goes on, you're much bigger than the water, much bigger than the soap. And it's true, but children don't know that when they hear this loud rush of the flush of water in the bathroom. They think they might be sucked down the drain. And so just to talk about it, people were very surprised that I would show a bathtub drain as well as a toilet drain and just say, you see, you could never go down such a small thing. Well, there were many children, I think, who breathed a sigh of relief just to be able to talk about it.
Can we talk about discipline? For a moment, you hear a lot that parents aren't disciplining their children enough now, that they're not setting limits and they're not being consistent about rules that they do have. Is that your experience looking back over your long work with kids? Are more parents dropping the ball on disciplining their children?
You know, Barbara, discipline is a kind of love. If children didn't have limits from those who cared about them, they would never feel that they were loved. If a child ran out into the street, for instance, and nobody screamed and says, come back, or nobody ran after that child would think that nobody loved him. So healthy limits, which children understand, are a marvelous way of saying, I care about you. I don't know about the numbers of people who give comfortable limits to their children anymore. I know that my grandchildren receive them all the time. But things that are clear, if children know why we're asking them to do things, they they often are very happy to do them, especially if they feel that it is consistent with our family values. Children love to belong, and if they know that this is the way our family does things, then they'll want to be part of it.
I have to ask you about the sweaters, and I'm sure you were asked about the sweaters that you wore on the show many, many times. But I understand your mother knitted most of them until her death.
She did. Mother was a great knitter. She would carry her knitting bag wherever she went. And she made a sweater a month. And at Christmas time, she would give 12 sweaters to this sort of extended family of ours. And invariably, she would say, "Okay, here's your sweater for Christmas, and here's the pattern book. Tell me which one you want for next year. Of course, I know the one Freddie wants. He wants the one with the zipper down the front." Well, I have all of those sweaters, and we used every one that she ever made for me. But that's been kind of a trademark, hasn't it, the sweater and the sneakers. And the sneakers came about because I had to run across the studio floor to get from the puppet set to the organ when I was doing the children's corner. And so the sneakers just became, I didn't want to make a lot of noise by running in other shoes.
Fred Rogers speaking with Barbara Bogave last November. We'll continue in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Barbara Bogave's 2002 interview with Fred Rogers.
What were you like as a kid?
I was an only child for 11 years, Barbara. And I had to make up a lot of my own fun.
I think you were sickly often, right? You had a lot of childhood diseases?
I had every imaginable childhood disease, even scarlet fever. And so whenever I was quarantined, and you know, they used to quarantine people for chicken pox and all of those things, I would be in bed a lot. And I certainly knew what it was like to use the counterpane as my neighborhood of make-believe, if you will.
You mean
I had puppets.
The window? You would use, what, finger puppets or shadow puppets or what?
And things on the bed. I would put up my knees and they would be mountains, you know, covered with the sheet. And I'd have all these little figures moving around and I'd make them talk. And I can still see my room. And I'm sure that was the beginning of a much later neighborhood of make-believe.
Was King Friday the 13th one of your childhood characters, or Lady Aberlin, or Lady Elaine?
The king probably had his genesis there, but it wasn't that particular name, because it was a child who helped us form that name, King Friday the 13th. A child had been told that Friday the 13th was a very bad day, and he was afraid of those Friday the 13ths. And so I just said one time, "Why don't we have a character whose name is Friday the 13th, and he celebrates his birthday every time a Friday lands on the 13th.
Oh, that's so unfair.
And so his birthday, King Friday's birthday, is always every Friday the 13th. And I hear from people all over the world. It's a joyous occasion for us. It might be otherwise for those who haven't been enlightened by the neighborhood. But this is King Friday the 13th. I must explain a few things to Miss Beebe. Yes, you're certainly welcome, King Friday. Friday the 13th is a fine day, and may you not say otherwise. Thank you.
Oh, it's taken me back.
This is Lady Elaine Toots. You ask about me, and I'm mighty glad you did. Have you ever been to my museum go-round? Well, you'll find everything that you could ever want in any one of those rooms.
Oh, this is X the Owl. You seem to be speechless, Barbara.
That's so true.
I'm just flying around here looking for you. There's Daniel Tiger over at his clock. Did you want to say hello to him? I mean, he's awful shy.
Well, I am shy, but I would like to say that I'm glad you're having fresh air.
Oh, thank you for that. So is that how you spent the weeks when you were in your bed as a kid, making up voices?
Yeah, voices for puppets and all kinds of stories. And then when I was 11 years old, my sister came, and then I wasn't an only child anymore.
Now, I think I also read that you were overweight as a kid. Did kids make fun of you? I mean, it sounds like you were probably shy because of this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think I'm still shy. I was concerned about coming to talk with you today. I want things to be right. I want them to be good. I worry if I make big mistakes. And that's quite a burden at times. But of course it can help when you're doing work that you feel is so important.
When you were in college, you studied music composition, and you also got a degree in child development, and you became an ordained Presbyterian minister. But after all those trying out, I guess, all those avocations, you went back to TV after that. Why didn't you pursue any of those other interests, music or the ministry?
Well, I feel that it's all wrapped up in what we do with the neighborhood and what we do with all of the things that we publish, that every part of who you are comes out in whatever assignment you have. But when I was ordained in the church, the ordination read like this: you are to continue your work for families and children through the mass media. So, you know, what better than to have these different identities and be able to wrap them all in the service of children and their families? I think that that's when I really knew who I was. When, I loved drama and I loved music and I loved puppetry and I liked television and I liked philosophy and religion. But the moment I realized that all of those could be used in the service of children and their families, that's when I knew who I was.
Now, did you have a model for your Mr. Rogers persona, the perfect adult, and someone you knew, maybe your father, your grandfather? Or...
Well, my grandfather McFeely used to say things to me, the kinds of things that I would say to the children on the air. We would visit him at his farm. Every Sunday we'd go out there for dinner.
McFeely as in Mr. McFeely on your show.
Exactly, yeah. And that's my middle name. And that was my mother's maiden name. But we would go to his farm for dinner on Sunday, and invariably he'd take us for a walk around the grounds and say things like, I'm so glad that you come. And when we leave, he would say, you've made this day a special day. Things like that, you know, that just your being yourself is what matters to me. And he would take me fishing, and he was a wonderful person.
Fred Rogers speaking with Barbara Bogave last November. He died yesterday at the age of 74. We'll continue this interview and hear a much earlier interview Terry did with Fred Rogers in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air.
It's such a good feeling to know you're alive. It's such a happy feeling. You're growing inside, and when you wake up ready to say, I think I'll make a snappy new day. It's such a good feeling, a very good feeling, the feeling you know you're alive. It's such a good feeling to know you're in tune. It's such a happy feeling to find you're in bloom. And when you wake up ready to say, I think I'll make a snappy new day. It's such a good feeling, a very good feeling, the feeling you know that we're friends. It's such a good feeling to know you're alive. It's such a happy feeling. You're growing inside, and when you wake up ready to say, I think I'll make a snappy new day. It's such a good feeling, a very good feeling, the feeling you know that we're friends.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback Atonement by Ian McEwan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
That's Johnny Costa on piano. He was the pianist and musical director for Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Coming up, we'll hear more of Barbara Bogave's recent interview with the late Fred Rogers, as well as a conversation with him Terry Gross recorded nearly 20 years ago. Also, a review of the new independent film, All the Real Girls. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, back with more of our remembrance of Fred Rogers, the children's TV host who died yesterday at age 74. He spoke with Barbara Bogave last November.
You worked with the people on your show for decades. Many of them stayed for decades, right? And I was thinking that when people work together on a television show for so long, they often play some practical jokes on each other on the air just to keep things interesting. What kinds of pranks happened on the set of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood? Did they ever, sprinkle itch powder in your sweater or anything?
No, but there were times when they put rolled up newspaper in the toes of my shoes so that when I was singing the goodbye song, I would try to get on my shoes, and of course they were much too small for me to get into. So the camera didn't show the shoes those days, and I was going out with my heels over the backs. And then one time there was this blown-up, voluptuous lady made out of rubber in a huge one in my closet when I opened at the end of the program to put my sweater back in the closet. Here was this lady waiting for me.
What did you do?
We taped it over. But you couldn't do that in the days of live television, and of course that's the way we began.
I have to get you to tell this story. I understand once the actor Michael Keaton was on your show. You had many celebrities on the show, but he made a little bit more mischief than most.
Michael worked with us on the studio crew before he ever went to Hollywood. And he was in charge of the trolley, the movement of the trolley in my room, and also picture-picture. And so there's a little sliding door right under picture-picture where I put in the tape. And so
this is the magic picture projector, right?
It has a
projector,
slot. Yeah. Uh-huh. And one day I opened the slot to put the tape in, and I heard this voice say, "I'm ready to hear your confession, son." Well, that was Michael. And those are the kinds of things that, he's just a wonderful person.
There have been many spoofs of Mr. Rogers, as I'm sure you know, over the years. Eddie Murphy's on Saturday Night Live is perhaps the best known spoof. I remember National Lampoon also had a skit based on your show. What did you think of those? How did you feel about the ribbing you got over the years?
I think most of them were done with a great deal of affection. I remember meeting Eddie Murphy for the first time over at the RCA building. And he came out of his office, and I was walking down the hall, and he put his arms around me, and he said, "The real Mr. Rogers." And Mr. Carson, when I was with him one time, he said, "You know, Fred, we would never do these takeoffs about you if we didn't like you. We wouldn't care about making you famous." There have been some that have concerned me, though, Barbara. And one we learned of, and this was on local television, somebody dressed up in a sweater and sneakers and talked, they said, even more slowly than I talk. I did not see this, but he pretended that he was I. And he said, "Now, boys and girls, I want you to take your mother's hairspray and your daddy's cigarette lighter and press the buttons together, and you'll have a blowtorch." Well, he was meaning to be funny, you know, but it was done in the afternoon. So if any child, even one child, would have gotten the notion that was something that we had condoned and had tried such a thing, such a sexist thing, for one thing, that would have been disastrous. And so we were able to know about that because a family that watched the neighborhood wrote to us and told us about it. So we got it taken off the air.
Fred Rogers, speaking with Barbara Bogave last November, 1 month before he was diagnosed with stomach cancer. Coming up, a 1984 conversation between Fred Rogers and Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air. In 1984, Fred Rogers stopped by our neighborhood to visit with Terry Gross. At that point, he'd already been working in children's television for 30 years.
Was there somebody in your life who was the kind of figure for you, like you've become to so many children, who would, you know, like reassure you and, you know, want to discuss things with you? Of course, you can't actually step out of the TV and discuss it with all the kids, but you offer that to them. Was there someone like that for you?
I guess the closest person was my grandfather, Mr. McFeely. And, of course, we've named the Speedy Delivery Man for him. We called him Ding Dong because he taught us that childhood rhyme, Ding Dong Bell, Pussy in the Well. And everybody called him Ding Dong. He was the kind of person who would really support your strivings for autonomy. And while my parents and my grandmother were naturally very concerned about my health and hazards around, he was the kind of person who, when I would walk on one of his stone walls, for instance, they would say, "Better get down." Ding Dong would say, "Ah, let the kid walk on the wall. He's got to learn to do things for himself."
What were the things that really scared you when you were a child?
I think the most scary thing was being alone and thinking that maybe nobody would come to get me. And I think that beginning school was tough for me. That's probably why I've done so much work for children in this area. I think also I was frightened of the doctor, and that's probably why I've made all those videotapes about helping children know about what hospitalization is like before they go. Probably why I wrote that song, "I Like to Be Told," because I did. I liked to be told about things before I had to go do them.
Did you like scary movies or books?
I can't remember.
Did you go to the movies a lot?
I would go to the movies. It's hard for me to remember. I remember a couple movies that I liked. Shirley Temple. And I liked those kinds of stories that, she would always come out okay at the end. And I met Shirley Temple Black not too long ago. And I just sat beside her in awe. And I said, it was interesting because the first thing I said to her was, "You were one of my favorite people." She said, "Were." That was the first thing she said. And that really put me back. I expected her to say something about, I'm really glad that I could have been part of your childhood. But all she said was, "Were. I was one of your favorite people." Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is. Did she diminish in your esteem after saying that?
A little bit. But I think that so many people you put on pedestals when you see them from afar. And it's probably just not fair. to expect them to be as wonderful as you thought they would be when you met them.
What about when you were a teenager? Was that an uncomfortable experience, or were you... did you feel like you fit in with everybody in high school, which is, I think, a pretty traumatic time for a lot of people when they're growing up?
It sure is. I think that teenage years are probably uncomfortable for everybody. It's just that some seem to be able to carry it off with more elan than others. But it was tough for me at the beginning. And then I made a couple friends who found out that the core of me was okay. And one of them was the president or the head of the football team. He later became my best friend in high school. But it was after the beginning of that friendship that I was more accepted in school. Then I became the editor of the yearbook and finally the president of the student council by the end of high school. But I was a very shy person going into high school.
What did you think you were going to be when you got out of school and started a professional career?
I thought I was going to be a diplomat. And was thinking about going to a school for diplomacy. And then I changed my mind, and this was during college. I wanted to be a minister and was all set to go to seminary after college. But I saw this thing called television, and I saw people throwing pies in each other's faces and all kinds of demeaning behavior. And I thought, I would really like to try my hand at that and see what I could do. And so instead of going to the seminary after graduation, I got a job at NBC in New York and went there for 2 years before joining educational television.
You worked on the Hit Parade and the Kate Smith Hour, I think.
Mm-hmm, the Voice of Firestone and all of those programs.
It surprises me, I think, that you left for a fledgling station, a brand new station in educational television, which was also new. It sounds like it was very risky to do that. Why did you make that switch?
I don't know. It was Pittsburgh was closer to where I grew up. Maybe I wanted to. I had just gotten married in New York, and maybe I had wanted to go back. I'm not sure that's so. I think that it had to do with wanting to work with children, because every day that I had off at NBC, I would go and visit a daycare center or an orphanage or a hospital that cared for children. And I cannot tell you why. I'm sure it had very deep roots. But when I got to Pittsburgh, and there were only three or four of us working at QED then. We weren't even on the air. This was in November of 53, and we didn't go on the air until April of 54, 30 years ago. One of the secretaries and I did a children's program together because nobody else wanted to do a children's program. But we were doing all of these other things as well. Each of us had a salary of $75 a week. And out of our own pockets, we bought all of the props for the program. And we called the program the Children's Corner. And it was on an hour every day. And I expected that I would play the organ for the hostess to sing. She would introduce all of the films, which I, as the producer, would get from all over the country. They had to be free because we didn't have any budget. Well, I didn't realize it, but those films were very brittle at times. And, of course, everything was live, and we'd be on the air, and here would be a film showing, and it would break. We'd have to fill with something. And so the night before we went on the air, Mrs. Dorothy Daniel, who was the general manager of the station, gave me a little tiger puppet. So I called him Daniel for her. And when the first film broke, I just poked the puppet through, and this was just a very fanciful set with drawings on it. And I just poked him through, and it happened to be a clock where I poked him through. And he just said,
It's 5:02, and Columbus discovered America in 1492.
And that was the first thing that I ever said through puppetry on the air.
Wow.
But I just wanted you to know that necessity there was the mother of that invention, because it hadn't been planned. And so much that is spontaneous is what can be truly inspired. And I feel that all that I've done that's been really helpful and good has been inspired.
You went back to the seminary after doing children's programming for a while, right?
Well, I started with the station, and after we got that children's program going, it got to be so busy for us that the secretary and I both gave up all of our other duties to do the children's corner. As it got moving, the second year, I decided I would go to the seminary, so I went on my lunch hour and took courses just one at a time, never expecting that I would graduate. It took me 8 years, and I finally graduated and was ordained a minister in the Presbyterian Church.
Obviously, you're very religious, but I don't think you... it's not a denominational program, and I'm sure that's intentional on your part.
It's far from denominational and far from overtly religious. The last thing in the world that I would want to do would be something that's exclusive. I would hate to think that a child would feel excluded from the neighborhood by something that I said and did.
Can I just ask you one more thing before we go? You know how a lot of adults always say, God, I wish I was a child again. Do you ever wish you were 5 or 10 or 12?
Yes. But I'd like to be that with what I know now. And I think that I'd like that because there are a good many significant people in my life that I have lost through death, and I'd like to be able to talk with them again and tell them some things that I wasn't able to tell them then. In fact, I'd like to be able to tell them you are special.
Terry Gross speaking with Fred Rogers in 1984. He died yesterday at age 74.
Did you ever fall and hurt your hand or knee? Did you ever bite your tongue? Did you ever find the stinger of a bee stuck in your thumb? I did too. It seems the things that you do, I did too. When I was very new, I had lots of hurts and scares and worries. When I was growing up like you, did you ever trip and fall down on the stairs? Did you ever stub your toe? Did you ever dream of great big grizzly bears who wouldn't go? I did too. It seems the things that you do, I did too. When I was very new, I had lots of hurts and scares and worries. When I was growing up, when I was growing up, when I was growing up like you.
Coming up, John Powers reviews the new film, All the Real Girls. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
All the Real Girls is a new romantic drama by the young filmmaker David Gordon Green. His first film was George Washington. All the Real Girls was a big hit at this year's Sundance Film Festival, where it won a special jury prize for emotional truth. Film critic John Powers has a review.
For the last 25 years, American filmmakers have been chasing the ghost of the 1970s. That includes a terrific new generation, led by P.T. Anderson, Wes Anderson, and Spike Jonze, who are familiar with the freedoms enjoyed by the so-called Easy Riders and Raging Bulls, yet have a sensibility shaped by an era of diminished cinematic expectations. They make cult classics, not big-budget hits, tell original stories rather than milk old genres, prefer ensemble casts to lavish star vehicles, and they largely neglect broad social concerns in favor of exploring the beleaguered modern self, a variety of the higher navel-gazing which may have reached its peak in the recent movie adaptation. You find nearly all of these qualities in David Gordon Green. The gifted North Carolina-based filmmaker, who at age 27 seems poised to join their front ranks. In fact, his new movie, All the Real Girls, comes wrapped in the familiar Sundance hype that threatens to make real-world audiences feel oversold and underwhelmed. Set in a sleepy North Carolina mill town, All the Real Girls is a love story of almost dreamy simplicity. Its hero, Paul, played by Paul Schneider, is a 22-year-old idler who might have stepped out of a Raymond Carver short story. Emotionally immature, he spends his life hanging out with his buddies and caddishly bedding the local chicks. All that changes when he meets Noelle, that's Zoe Deschanel, a virginal young woman just back from boarding school. The two fall for each other instantly, achieving a tremulous honesty that delights and unsettles them both. Yet in ways they can't possibly understand, their lives are terribly out of sync. While Paul seeks salvation in Noelle's innocence, she makes me decent, he says, and won't sleep with her. She wants to learn the songs of experience. Here, Paul tries to tell her about his past.
I've made some ugly mistakes.
The girls?
The most really ugly. And anything that would make you feel more comfortable for you to know, I want to tell you that stuff. Because I care about you. Because I care about you. Oh. A lot. And when, you know, when people from before come up, yeah, I want you to understand. What they hate when they see me.
As he showed on his $50,000 debut, George Washington, David Gordon Green is attuned to the poetry of ordinary life, with its slow patches and sudden bursts of deep emotion. He knows the thrill of confessing your most painful secret, or how a silly dance at a bowling alley can be the most magical thing on earth. This isn't the glib, saccharine teen love story you normally see in the movies. Green understands how profoundly romantic betrayal can shake up the young. Paul faces the shattering discovery that his beloved is capable of going to bed with someone else, while Noelle has the epiphany that she can love Paul, sleep with another guy, and in that very moment realize how much she loves Paul. Of the two, Noelle is by far the more compelling creation. She's played with enormous honesty by Deschanel, whose wide-open face has the emotional transparency you found in Gwyneth Paltrow before she got so grand. Gazing out from her intent raccoon eyes, Deschanel makes us feel the vibrancy of a young woman who's discovering her own capacity for startling herself. By comparison, the inarticulate Paul is so emotionally arrested that I kept wondering why all the local women should be so interested in him. Green is essentially a poet of moods rather than a teller of tales, and he adorns this movie with studied stylistic touches influenced by 70s wonder boy Terrence Malick, who made Badlands and Days of Heaven. The movie has dialogue that veers toward the literary, juxtaposes nature against man-made violence, and has a burnished visual style that seeks to elevate commonplace reality through sheer beauty. And the film is beautiful. Shot on exquisite widescreen by Tim Orr, it gives us a world bathed in golden light. It's also bathed, I have to tell you, in a wash of artistic self-importance. Like many young directors, Green is a bit self-serious, especially in his attempt to make this two-person romance become some sort of commentary on small-town life in general. That's frankly more significance than this small, delicate love story can really support. Still, you have to be pretty harsh to dwell on the whiff of pretension in an ambitious young filmmaker with as much natural talent as Green. That's the sort of thing that time will burn away. Anyway, as Noel tells Paul near the end of the movie, nobody ever said we had to be perfect.
John Powers is film critic and media columnist for LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. We'll end today's program with more music from Johnny Costa. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inculli.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Blue Poppies, a novel set in 1950s Tibet by Jonathan Falla. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, rebuilding the World Trade Center. We'll talk about the new design for the site with Paul Goldberger, architecture critic for the New Yorker magazine. Join us for the next Fresh Air.